Today on Flashpoints, legendary historian and author Noam Chomsky on the global economic crisis. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Robert Knight. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Up next, Flashpoints producer Robert Knight and Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Introduces legendary historian Noam Chomsky at a speech he gave at the Riverside Church in New York City. This broadcast was presented by WBAI and moderated by our own Robert Knight.
You're listening to a live broadcast from WBAI and Pacifica Radio of Noam Chomsky's major address, Crisis and Hope, Theirs and Ours. The program originates from New York City's historic Riverside Church. Riverside describes itself as, quote, an interdenominational, interracial, and international congregation, quote, and the church combines this Gothic architecture with modern politics. Riverside's founders committed the church to global politics and social justice rather than the more conservative approach of Christian fundamentalism, and the history of Riverside has repeatedly confronted that mission. Last year, the New York Times described Riverside as, quote, a stronghold of activism and political debate throughout its 75-year history, end quote. It was here, in this very hall of Riverside Church, that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. first enunciated his seminal opposition to the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, thereby uniting the civil rights and anti-war movements in his Beyond Vietnam address of April 4, 1967.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. I join you in this meeting because I am in deepest agreement with the aims and work of the organization which has brought us together, clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart. I found myself in full accord when I read its opening lines. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam.
Martin Luther King speaking here at Riverside in April 1967, 1 year before his assassination. Other world leaders have graced Riverside's elevated podium, including the recently retired president of Cuba, Fidel Castro, who spoke here a decade ago in 1999.
Congregados.
Dear brothers and sisters,
yo decidí.
I decided that I'd better go to Harlem.
Porque ahí están,
because it is there, in Harlem,
mis mejores amigos,
but I will find my best friends.
Lo que entiendo es así.
As far as I have understood, Riverside, in Spanish that would mean close to the river, but amidst a river.
Es en medio del río.
Which is the river of the healthiest and most novel friendship.
Riverside has also hosted such notable leaders as the former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, who spoke after the attacks of September 2001, along with innumerable leaders of nations, movements, the arts, and social reform. The church is also memorable for its memorial services for such notables as the late great actor and activist Ossie Davis, who himself famously eulogized Malcolm X as our bright shining prince. Other Riverside commemorations include those for composer Max Roach, and most recently, the internationally renowned folk singer Odetta. And now, in the spirit of Riverside's pledge to pursue, quote, education, reflection, and action for peace and justice, quote, the renowned semanticist, researcher, and political analyst Noam Chomsky will soon join that human pantheon of Riverside speakers with tonight's address, Crisis and Hope, Theirs and Ours. Chomsky promises to address, among many other things, the global economy, military intervention, and the presidency of Barack Obama on this 40th anniversary of the publication of his classic book, American Power and the New Mandarins. At the Riverside Church in New York City for WBAI and the Pacifica Radio Network, I'm Robert Knight.
It is such a great honor to be here tonight to make this introduction. As we're standing here, I was thinking back 14 years ago. It was 1995. It was mid-November. There was a forum on globalization that was taking place here at Riverside. And it was there that I heard the announcement that Ken Sarawiwa and eight other Ogoni activists had been executed in Nigeria. Ken Sarawiwa, who is the writer environmentalist, who had dared to take on the nexus of corporate and military power, the military dictatorship of Nigeria and Shell Corporation, which had crisscrossed his land in the Niger Delta, Ogoni land, with gas pipelines above the ground, burning off the gas in flares the size of apartment buildings, the children of the Niger Delta never knowing a dark night, and yet not profiting from the drilling and taking the power out of the earth and giving it to the most powerful on earth, disempowering the host communities from which it had come. I had met Ken Sarawiwa in 1994 when a Nigerian activist brought him into the studios of WBAI. We were doing wake-up call that morning, and Bernard White and I sat there as Ken Sarawiwa, who was not one of the scheduled guests that morning, held forth. And he told the story of what he was confronting in Nigeria, saying the world had to know, and ending by saying, "I am a marked man." He returned to Nigeria, was imprisoned, was tried, and he was executed. Last week, as we sat in the studios of Democracy Now!, we broadcast the voice of Ken from those days on WBAI, and we broadcast his son, Ken Wiwa, who was announcing that they had just won a settlement with Shell that took 14 years, but they would then win $15.5 million for the Wiwa family and other victims and the people of Ogoni land. We also played the words of Ken Sarawiwa's father, Jim Wiwa, who Jeremy Scahill and I got to meet in the Niger Delta in Ogoni land when we visited 3 years after Ken's death, when Jim Wiwa said directly to us, "Shell is responsible for my son's death." And as we sat there listening to the father, the son, and the grandson, I was sitting next to Judith Brown Chomsky. She was our guest for the hour. Judith Brown Chomsky was one of the leading attorneys in this case that led to this landmark settlement. When I asked Noam tonight how he would like to be introduced, he said, "Tell them I'm the brother-in-law of Judith Brown Chomsky." Judith is married to Noam's younger brother, David. Noam was born December 7th, 1928, in Philadelphia. By the age of 10, he was writing an extended essay against fascism and about the Spanish Civil War. Don't be discouraged. At 14, he was getting his education, as he tells it, in the back of the 72nd Street subway station here in New York. You go out the front, that's where you go buy newspapers, in the front newspaper stand where people would rush by, buy their papers and go. But it was the back, less populated stand where the stragglers would be, where his uncle ran that newspaper stand. And they would sit and debate and discuss politics.
That's where Noam says he was getting his education. I hear that they just opened the back again about 4 years ago, the south side of the 72nd Street subway station, but I understand they removed the newspaper stand. Maybe they're a little concerned about some young Chomskys getting educated for the future. Well, within 2 years, that education clearly got him far, because at 16, he was at the University of Pennsylvania. He went on to be to the Harvard Society of Fellows, where he continued his research into linguistics. By 1953, Chomsky broken almost entirely from the field as it existed. He became a professor at the University of Massachusetts, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in 1955 at the age of 26. I forgot to say he'd already gotten his PhD again at the University of Pennsylvania. And while he broke ground as a world-renowned linguist, shattering all previous paradigms in linguistics, in a world I know very little about, he was also taking on the war in Vietnam, so much so that his lifetime partner, his wife, Carol, went back to school to get her graduate degree in linguistics so that she could be, if need be, the breadwinner if Noam was imprisoned. That's how she described it. She went on to be a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education of Linguistics and also broke ground on child language acquisition. Noam and Carol have known each other since I think he was three. And he only lost Carol a few months ago, this lifetime partnership, a great model for relationships. His personal life, also a model for all of us of what it means to live a life of integrity. On Democracy Now!, we have interviewed Noam many times. And I think about 2002. It was around midnight. It was May 20th. Journalist Alan Nairn and I were in East Timor. It was a momentous time. After a quarter of a century of slaughter, of genocide, the people of East Timor were celebrating their freedom, those who had survived. The Indonesian military had killed off a third of the population. And I remember that night clearly as Kofi Annan, then UN Secretary General, took the stage as they were handing over the power from the United Nations to the people of East Timor, and then Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, the founding president of East Timor, ascended to the podium and unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. The light of the fireworks was reflected in the tear-stained faces of the people of Timor. They had resisted and they had won at an unbelievably high price, but they had won. We were broadcasting this historic moment over the airwaves of Pacifica Radio throughout the United States. And at that moment, we called Noam, because it was Noam Chomsky, since 1975, actually on his birthday, on December 7th, when Indonesia invaded East Timor, who never let this story die. In so many of his books, so much of his writing, so many of his speeches, often introducing to people this point on a map so many thousand miles from us, and he let people know what was happening in your name. It was Noam who told us about what was happening in Timor and led us to take those trips to try to expose what was happening. And I bet almost everyone here tonight in this sanctuary has a story about discovering Noam's writings or his voice or his words and how it has changed your life. When I am most affected as I travel the country are the young soldiers who come up to me. And when I ask them what made the difference, why they turned, why they could be, how they could be so brave and courageous and resisting war, so often these young men and women will say, "Someone handed me a book of Noam Chomsky." Arundhati Roy said something wonderful about Nome in her book War Talk. Arundhati Roy, who spoke here in May of 2003. She has a chapter, The Loneliness of Noam Chomsky, where she writes, "When I first read Noam Chomsky, it occurred to me that his marshalling of evidence, the volume of it, the relentlessness of it, was a little, how shall I put it, insane. Even a quarter of the evidence he'd compiled would have been enough to convince me. I used to wonder why he needed to do so much work. But now I understand that the magnitude and intensity of Chomsky's work is a barometer of the magnitude, scope, and relentlessness of the propaganda machine that he's up against. He's like the wood borer who lives inside the third rack of my bookshelf. Day and night, I hear his jaws crunching through the wood, grinding it to fine dust. It's as though he disagrees with the literature and wants to destroy the very structure on which it rests. I call him Chomsky. Being an American, working in America, writing to convince Americans of his point of view must really be like having to tunnel through hard wood. Chomsky is one of a small band of individuals fighting a whole industry, and that makes him not only brilliant, but heroic." His work, so prolific, his personal support for so many, so important. Just this afternoon, Norm Finkelstein was telling me how he had visited Noam one summer at the beginning, went away, came back at the end, and Noam had already written two books. And so he said to a friend, "Noam just finished two books." And his friend said, "So I read two books this summer too." He said, "No, but he wrote them." And I think of calling Noam Chomsky in Turkey. It was February of 2002. He had not just gone there to speak, but to stand with a young publisher named Fatih Tas, who was facing years in prison for publishing Noam Chomsky's work. I called Noam to interview him before he went to court, not knowing what would happen to him as well. When I rang him up, he answered the phone and he said, "Amy, do you know what time it is?" I thought I had calculated correctly. He said, "It's 4 a.m. I said, "I can call you back." He said, "No, I'm up now. Let's talk." But it's that bravery, that courage, Noam's resistance to the war in Vietnam and his writing about the wars in Vietnam, the death squads in Latin America, what happened to Vietnam and Cambodia, what is happening today in Israel and Palestine, his opposition to the wars in Iraq, his relentlessness that is such an inspiration to us all. I think, looking at The Essential Chomsky, edited by Anthony Arnov, this bookcase that is on the cover is filled with Noam Chomsky's books. He's written over 100 of them. And it's not just writing, because when he explodes the lies, he is saving lives, because the lies take lives. I don't know who said this quote, but someone once said, "I think back on my life at all the times I thought I went too far, and I realize now I didn't go far enough." Well, I think Noam Chomsky has clearly gone the distance. And as we celebrate his 80 years, I am encouraged by a woman who told me about celebrating her grandmother's 106th birthday. And her grandmother stood up at her party and said, "Ah, to be 100 again." We look forward to hearing Noam Chomsky for many years to come, beginning with tonight. Noam Chomsky.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of Crisis and Hope, Dares and Hours, a special presentation by Noam Chomsky here at the Riverside Church in New York City. He has just been introduced by Amy Goodman, and there is a standing ovation among the full house here inside the Riverside Church with a seating capacity of 4,000.
Thanks. It was really exciting to watch Amy a couple of days ago when she was interviewing Judy. It's an amazing achievement. I won't go into the whole story, but it took a lot of courage and effort to win a completely unprecedented case. I don't think there's ever been a case of a settlement like that that was where the evidence was, which she had in fact gathered in Nigeria, that was so strong that the corporation not only settled, but even allowed the settlement to be public, indicating their concern that they might be exposed in the trial. Let me say a couple of words about the title, which as always is shorthand. There's too much nuance and variety to make any sharp distinction between us and them. And of course, neither I nor anyone else can presume to speak for us. But I'll pretend it's possible. There's also a problem about the word crisis. Which one do we have in mind? There are numerous, very severe crises. Many of them will be under discussion here in a couple of weeks at the United Nations and their conference on the world financial and economic crisis. And these crises are interwoven in very complex ways, which make it, which preclude any sharp separation. But again, I'll pretend otherwise for simplicity. Well, one way to enter this morass was helpfully provided by a current issue of the New York Review, dated yesterday. The front cover headline reads, "How to Deal with the Crisis." It features a symposium of specialists. That's worth reading. But with attention to the definite article, the crisis. For the West, the phrase "the crisis" has a clear enough meaning. It's the financial crisis that hit the rich countries and therefore is of supreme importance. But in fact, even for the rich and privileged, that's by no means the only crisis or even the most severe of those they face. And others see the world quite differently. For example, the newspaper New Nation in Bangladesh. There we read, "It's very telling that trillions have already been spent to patch up leading world financial institutions, while out of the comparatively small sum of $12 billion pledged in Rome earlier this year to offset the food crisis, only $1 billion has been delivered. The hope that at least extreme poverty can be eradicated by the end of 2015, as stipulated in the UN's Millennium Development Goals, seems as unrealistic as ever, not due to lack of resources, but to a lack of true concern for the world's poor." They're talking about approximately 1 billion people facing starvation, severe malnutrition, even 30, 40 million of them in the richest country in the world. That's a real crisis, and it's getting much worse. In this morning's Financial Times, British Business Press, it's reported that the World Food Program just announced that they're cutting food aid and rations and also closing operations. The reason is that the donor countries have been cutting back funding because of the fiscal crunch, and they're slashing contributions. So a very close connection between the horrendous food crisis and poverty crisis and the significant but less significant fiscal crisis. They're ending up closing down operations in Rwanda, Uganda, Ethiopia, many others. They have to 20 to 25% cut in budget, while food prices are rising, and the financial crisis, the general economic crisis, is bringing unemployment and cutting back remittances. That's a major crisis. We might incidentally remember that when the British landed in what's now Bangladesh, they were stunned by its wealth and splendor, and didn't take long for it to be on its way to become the very symbol of misery, not by an act of God. Well, the fate of Bangladesh should remind us that the terrible food crisis is not just the result of Western lack of concern. In large part, it results from very definite and clear concerns of the global managers, namely for their own welfare. It's always well to keep in mind an astute observation by Adam Smith about policy formation in England. He recognized that what he called the principal architects of policy, in his day the merchants and manufacturers, make sure that their own interests are most peculiarly attended to, however grievous the impact on others, including the people of England, but far more so those who were subjected to what he called the savage injustice of the Europeans, and particularly in conquered India, his own prime concern. We can easily think of analogs today. His observation, in fact, is one of the few solid and enduring principles of international and domestic affairs, well, to keep in mind. And the food crisis is a case in point. It erupted first and most dramatically in Haiti in early 2008. Like Bangladesh, Haiti is a symbol of utter misery. And like Bangladesh, when the European explorers arrived, they were stunned because it was so remarkably rich in resources. Later it became the source of much of France's wealth. I'm not going to run through the sordid history, it's worth knowing, but the current food crisis traces back directly to Woodrow Wilson's invasion of Haiti, which was murderous and brutal and destructive. Among Wilson's many crimes was to dissolve the Haitian parliament at gunpoint because it refused to pass what was called progressive legislation, which would allow U.S. businesses to take over Haitian lands. Wilson's Marines then ran a free election in which the legislation was passed by 99.9% of the vote. That's of the 5% of the population permitted to vote. All of this comes down to us as what's called Wilsonian idealism. Later, USAID instituted programs in Haiti to turn it, under the slogan of turning Haiti into the Taiwan of the Caribbean by adhering to the sacred principle of comparative advantage. That is, they should import from the United States while working people, mostly women, slaved under miserable conditions in U.S.-owned assembly plants. Haiti's first free election in 1990 threatened these economically rational programs. The poor majority made the mistake of entering the political arena and electing their own candidate, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a populist priest. And Washington instantly adopted standard operating procedures, moving at once to undermine the regime. A couple of months later came the military coup, instituting a horrible reign of terror, which was backed by Bush won, and even more so by Clinton. By 1994, Clinton decided that the population was sufficiently intimidated, and he sent U.S. forces to restore the elected president. That's now called a humanitarian intervention, but on very strict conditions, namely that the president accept a very harsh neoliberal regime, in particular, no protection for the economy. Haitian rice farmers are quite efficient, but they can't compete with U.S. agribusiness that relies on a huge government subsidy, thanks to Ronald Reagan's free market enthusiasms. Well, there's nothing at all surprising about what followed next. In 1995, USAID wrote a report pointing out, I'm quoting it, that the export-driven trade and investment policy that Washington mandated will relentlessly squeeze the domestic rice farmer. In fact, the neoliberal policies rammed down Haiti's throat, destroyed, dismantled what was left of economic sovereignty, drove the country into chaos, and that was accelerated by Bush number two's banning of international aid on totally cynical grounds. In February 2004, the two traditional torturers of Haiti, France and the United States, combined to back a military coup and send President Aristide off to Africa. The U.S. denies him permission to return to the entire region. Haiti had by then lost the capacity to feed itself, making it highly vulnerable to food price fluctuation. That was the immediate cause of the 2008 food crisis, which led to riots and enormous protests, but not getting food. The story is familiar, in fact, quite similar in much of the world. So going back to the Bangladesh newspaper, it's true enough that the food crisis results from a Western lack of concern. A pittance by our standards would overcome its worst immediate effects. But more fundamentally, it results from the dedication to Adam Smith's principles of business-run state policy. These are all matters that we too easily evade. They happen daily, along with the fact that bailing out banks is not uppermost in the minds of the billion people now facing starvation, not forgetting the tens of millions enduring hunger in the richest country in the world. Well, also sidelined is a easy way to make a significant dent in the financial and the food crises. It's suggested by the publication a couple of days ago of the authoritative annual report on military spending by SIPRI, the Swedish Peace Research Institute. The scale of military spending is phenomenal, regularly increasing this last year as well. The U.S. is responsible for almost as much as the rest of the world combined, seven times as much as its nearest rival, China. No need to waste time commenting. This distribution of concerns reflects another crisis here, kind of a cultural crisis, that is the tendency to focus on short-term parochial gains. And that's a core element of our socioeconomic institutions and the ideological support system on which they rest. One example, now prominent, is the array of perverse incentives that are devised for corporate managers to enrich themselves. For example, what's called the too-big-to-fail insurance policies that are provided by the unwitting public, and deeper ones. They're just inherent in market inefficiencies. One such inefficiency, now recognized to be one of the roots of the financial crisis, is the underpricing of systemic risk, the risk that affects the whole system. So, for example, and that's general, like if you and I make a transaction, say you sell me a car, we may make a good deal for ourselves, but we don't price into that transaction the cost to others. And there's a cost, pollution, congestion, raising the price of gas, all sorts of other things, killing people in Nigeria because we're getting the gas from them. That doesn't count when we don't count that in. That's an inherent market inefficiency, one of the reasons why markets can't work. And when you turn to the financial institutions, it can get quite serious. So it means that, say, Goldman Sachs, if they're managed properly, if they make a risky loan, they calculate the potential cost to themselves if the loan goes bad, but they simply don't calculate the impact on the whole financial system. And we now see how severe that can be. Not that it's anything new. In fact, this inherent deficiency of markets, this inefficiency of markets, is perfectly well known. 10 years ago, at the height of the euphoria about efficient markets, two prominent economists, John Eatwell and Lance Taylor, they wrote an important book in which, called Global Finance at Risk, in which they spelled out the consequences of these market inefficiencies, which we now see, and they outlined means to deal with them. These proposals were exactly contrary to the deregulatory rage that was then being carried forward by the Clinton administration under the leadership of those who Obama has now called upon to put band-aids on the disaster that they helped create. Well, in substantial measure, the food crisis plaguing much of the South and the financial crisis of the North have common roots, namely the shift towards neoliberalism since the 1970s. That brought to an end the post-war, post-Second World War Bretton Woods system that was instituted by the United States and Britain right after World War II. It had two architects, John Maynard Keynes, Britain, and Harry Dexter White in the United States, and they anticipated that its core principles, which included capital controls and regulated currencies, they anticipated that these principles would lead to relatively balanced economic growth and would also free governments to institute the social democratic programs, welfare state programs, that had enormous public support around the world. And to a large extent, they were vindicated on both counts. In fact, many economists call the years that followed until the 1970s the golden age of capitalism. That golden age led not only to unprecedented and relatively egalitarian growth, but also the introduction of welfare state measures. Keynes and White were perfectly well aware that free capital movement and speculation inhibit these options. Professional economics literature points out, what should be obvious, that the free flow of capital creates what they sometimes call a virtual senate of lenders and investors who carry out a moment-by-moment referendum on government policies. And if they find that they're irrational, meaning they help people instead of profits, then they vote against them by capital flight, by tax on the country, and so on. So the democratic governments have a dual constituency, their own population and the virtual Senate, who typically prevail. And for the poor, that means regular disaster. In fact, one of the differences, one of the reasons for the radical difference between Latin America and East Asia in the last half century is that Latin America didn't control capital flight. In fact, in general, the rich in Latin America don't have responsibilities. Capital flight approximated the crushing debt. In contrast, during South Korea's remarkable growth period, capital flight was not only banned, but could bring the death penalty, one of many factors that led to the surprising divergence. Latin America has much richer resources. You'd expect it to be far more advanced than East Asia, but it had the disadvantage of being under imperialist wings. From the 1970s, the golden age faded. When neoliberal rules were observed, insofar as they've been observed, economic performance deteriorated and social democratic programs have been substantially weakened. We see that right here. The United States partially accepted these rules, and for the past 30 years, real wages for the majority of the population have stagnated. Up till then, they essentially tracked growth. Work hours have increased, now well beyond Europe. Benefits, which have always lagged, have declined. Social indicators, kind of general measure of the health of the society, they also tracked growth until the mid-1970s when they began to decline, reaching the 1960 level by the end of the millennium. Well, there has been economic growth, but it's finding its way into very few pockets, increasingly into the financial industries, which have grown enormously, while productive industry has significantly declined. And we're seeing it right now. And with the decline of productive industry, of course, that means decline in living standards, in fact, even opportunities to survive for much of the workforce. The economy has also been punctuated by bubbles, financial crises, and public bailouts. So the huge bailout of Citigroup right now is nothing new. Something quite similar happened in the early 80s to its predecessor, Citibank, thanks to the U.S. taxpayer. These results were described right all through this period and explained by a few really outstanding international economists. David Felix is one. But the mythology about efficient markets and rational choice prevailed. And that's not at all surprising. These myths were highly beneficial to very narrow sectors of privilege and power, what Adam Smith called the principal architects of policy. That's another very severe institutional and cultural crisis which persists.
That was legendary historian and author Noam Chomsky speaking recently in New York City. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.